Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Well, we just passed the inauguration of Donald J. Trump as the 47th President of the United States. And there's a lot of excitement and hope for conservatives about making America great again. But make no mistake, it's going to be an uphill battle for this administration against fierce resistance from the radical left on the one hand and the entrenched deep state on the other. So we can hardly afford to get complacent. And it will take more than just politics to make America great again. That's obviously an important arena in which to do battle, but the real fight is in the culture. And it's not just a fight to make America great, but to literally save or reclaim, however you want to look at it, Western civilization in the broader sense. Because the West, as you know, if you care about preserving the greatest civilization in human history, and I know you do if you listen to this podcast and read my writing, the West is in the fight of its life against forces united and arrayed against it both externally and internally to deconstruct and dismantle the West in order to erect a multiculturalist collectivist utopia on its ruins. Now, that all sounds very overblown to put it that way, but all one has to do to confirm that it's actually happening is to look around you at the civilizational decline not only in our country, but throughout the Western world, especially in a Western Europe that is teetering on the brink of collapse thanks to the globalist elites and the mass migration they have facilitated that is subverting and transforming a spiritually and culturally desiccated European old world from within. As the saying goes, civilizations die not so much from murder as from suicide. Making Western civilization great again is my concern. That's been the focus of my writing for a long time. And today on The Right Take, I'm going to be talking with a very smart guy who is the author of, among many other articles and books as well, a recent article about what he calls the death wish of Western civilization. I thought the piece had a lot of interesting ideas worth exploring. And if you've listened to this podcast from early on, you may remember him from one of my first episodes. I'm very glad to have him back to talk about this urgent topic. So please stay with us here at the intersection of politics and culture. You don't want to miss this interview. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the other important conversations we are having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is literally a gentleman and a scholar. He's been the president of the National Association of Scholars since 2009. That's 16 years, which is a pretty incredible testament to the quality of both his scholarship and his leadership. He's the award-winning author of a few books, among them one titled 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project, and one called Wrath, America Enraged. I've read both. I can't recommend them highly enough. In fact, I had him on as an early guest in this podcast, and we talked about both those books. Peter Wood, welcome back to the Right Take Podcast.
Well, so good to be back. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for making the time. What exactly goes on at the National Association of Scholars? What's your mission there?
Our mission is to promote the traditional liberal arts, intellectual freedom, the pursuit of truth, and the cultivation of virtuous citizenship. Primarily through colleges and universities, although increasingly we recognize that higher education is not just limited to colleges and universities. There are other avenues as well.
Before we move on to a recent article that you wrote, which I wanted to get you to elaborate on, let me ask you again about your book, Wrath, America Enraged, which is about political anger in America. It's something we're all unfortunately painfully familiar with. And it's what you call the new anger. What is the new anger?
New anger is performative anger, anger that's demanding that people pay attention to me because I'm full of wrath and demand your attention. Oftentimes, new anger is more performance than actual emotional distress, but it has become a mechanism by which people engaged in public life, political life, try to rally others to their cause. although I don't think it's limited to politics, new anger has become part of the fabric of our social life in every other dimension as well.
Yeah, do you think that since your book came out about 3 years ago, that political wrath in America is waning or intensifying?
I think it has intensified. I think that it also is a significant component of how President Trump returned to the White House. The book itself is a call for people to harness their rage to some constructive purpose. And for me, that meant responding to the depredations against the common good that we saw starting, well, not starting, but kind of reaching a peak in the 2020 electoral season.
Well, about directing that anger appropriately, that brings me to a question that might make a good segue to the article that you wrote, which I'll get to next. But in the book Wrath, you state that you hope to teach readers how to put some righteous anger to good use in the effort to save our country and our civilization from an approaching barbarism. How can our righteous anger be directed strategically and peacefully?
Well, the one form that I just mentioned was becoming engaged in a constructive way with our republic, trying to make sure that the conditions in which we learned to be self-governing 2.5 centuries ago can be sustained to the next generation. That also has an educational component, because our republic doesn't survive unless we teach those values to each coming generation and find ways to make the participation in public life attractive and rewarding in the sense of an emotional fulfillment, not in the crass material sense. The constructiveness of anger comes from basically sublimating it. If you're angry against your spouse or against your children or against your parents, that's going to have a very destructive effect unless you find a way to bring those matters that distress you into a form of expression that improves the relations with the people who are close to you. So that's taking it from the side of the most intimate forms of anger to the most extended forms of anger, as in when we see students rioting on campus demanding the destruction of Israel or the death of Jews. That's performative anger as well. I'm not sure there is any constructive place for that anger, but that doesn't mean that we can't respond to it in a way that is more constructive than simply denouncing it.
Well, the book is fascinating, Wrath, America, Enraged. I urge everybody to read it. But let's get to your article. You and I have a mutual friend, filmmaker Gloria Greenfield, who has a website for her production company. That's docemmettproductions.com, D-O-C-E-M-E-T productions.com. And that website features a blog page in which she invites notable thinkers and writers and activists to contribute articles that are what she calls deep dives into the dangers to Western civilization. I've been honored to contribute several times, actually, myself, and I felt strongly that your recent piece there called Death Wish was worth a deep dive into on its own. You open the article with this question: can Western civilization survive? Now, I and many others think that's a crucial question, an issue, but I imagine there are many who think it's pretty melodramatic to talk about something as grandiose as the end of Western civilization and how we can save it. But is it overstating or exaggerating things to talk about the impending death of the West? Are we just wringing our hands about civilizational doom as every generation does, or is it a very real possibility?
I think it's a real possibility. The very real depends on us. We can choose to ignore what's been happening, and in which case I think we end up accelerating it, or we can make this a matter of existential concern, if that's not too melodramatic. The fate of our, not just our nation, but of the greater constellation of nations we call the Western civilization, I think does hang in the balance. As I say in the article, there are numbers of ways that could that be approached. One is the idea that we're going to lose some cataclysmic war. I don't rule out that possibility. We have certainly powerful enemies, and we have our own weaknesses in the face of those enemies. But the article concentrates more on our sense of who we are and whether that's a presence that we care to sustain against the internal forms of rot. I think we could face off against the Chinese or the Russians, the Iranians, etc., if we had to, and maybe we will, but we're only going to do that if we have confidence that there is something here worth defending and something that may require us to sacrifice our lives and a lot more in order to prevail. That's the question I try to take up in the article.
You mentioned that civilization has been on the brink of elimination before and even gone over the edge on several occasions, but it's always managed to reassemble itself, but with some irreparable loss each time. Like you mentioned, World War I as an example. And you worry that we're facing something more devastating than that this time, something we won't be able to bounce back from. Not because of external foes, which, as you mentioned, are a legitimate threat, but by a death wish in our culture. Is that what you're talking about? Sense of identity that we are losing, and it's becoming a literal death wish in our culture?
Yes, I think that what's happened is that we've become so accustomed to looking upon our past and even our present as filled with the desire to oppress others or the guilt for having been involved in such forms of oppression like slavery, that we no longer see ourselves as worthy of being saved, that the world would be better off had we never existed, but the best we can do now is to hasten our exit from the world stage as soon as we can. Now, that said, between you and me, sounds a little bit silly, but I think we both know that there are millions of American students, not just college students, but even students in high school, who have bought into the idea that we are unworthy to the nth degree, that this is a civilization that had best hasten itself off the stage.
Is that due to the impact of this cultural concept of multiculturalism, which essentially validates all other cultures except Western civilization, which is seen as the fount of all oppression and exploitation and evil in the past?
Well, I think multiculturalism is certainly implicated in this. The interest in promoting the fortunes of other peoples against our own is something that wasn't invented overnight. It's probably had a half century or so of gestation as it has taken form. I'm of an age when I remember the forms of education still promoted a certain sense of esteem for what our culture had achieved in its several millennia of development. That's no longer the case. The teaching of ancient history has almost vanished. The teaching of what happened in the West between the fall of the Roman Empire and the rise of the nation state has a very attenuated existence. Those things are no longer deemed essential knowledge for people growing up. And if you don't learn it then, the chances of ever really learning it diminish even further. So we've become sort of re-ignorant. There was a time when people who had no chance for an education might not know too much of the past, but people who had the privilege of education did. Now it's the people who are getting the privilege of education who know the least about what happened. Those who are not attending good schools or colleges might, for example, still have a good knowledge of the Bible, which would go a long way towards giving them some sense of where we came from. But the past has become for us a kind of toy that is used by Hollywood and other entertainments to create imaginary pasts, fictions that frequently present the progenitors of Western civilization as the villains, and the people that they fought wars with were unjustly put down and neglected. So it's not that Americans have lost any sense of history. They've just taken the sense of history in which the West was an achievement and replaced it with a sense of the West as a place that was the great villain that now has finally met its comeuppance. I think that partly explains why so many people are willing to champion the cause of Hamas after it commits bloody massacres in Israel. And it's sort of taking the side of something that is definitely not Western civilization, that engages in what we used to call and probably should still call barbarism, and says, we're fine with that, we're good with that, that's our future destiny.
If anything positive could be said about the COVID pandemic, it's that it awakened a lot of parents to what was actually being taught to their children while they weren't paying attention. And so I think there's been a lot of focus from the average American parent now on their children's education and the indoctrination they've been receiving. And I see also that there seems to be a huge resurgence in interest in classical education. So do you think that those of us who care about Western civilization and want to defend it and promote its values, do you think that we might be gaining the cultural momentum now?
Well, we certainly are gaining momentum. Whether it's fair to say it's the cultural momentum, I'm a little hesitant on. When you look at the numbers of students who attend classical academies, Christian schools, things like that, compared to the numbers who are still enrolled in the government schools, it's a very, very small percentage. I am very happy that small percentage exists. You mentioned COVID. Let me dilate on that a little bit. Yes, the awakening of parents to what was being assigned to their children in schools was one of two really good things that came out of the COVID episode. The other one was the increasing skepticism towards authorities who were announcing their plans as though they were speaking for all of science. So both those things are very constructive, that we have allowed the make-believe science to supplant actual inquiry into the truth as an important part of the resurgence of Western civilization too. If I could summon that the parents who were concerned about their students or their children and are doing something about it, whether it's attending school board meetings or taking their children into homeschooling or something like that, if I could summon that along with this robust spirit of people like Jay Bhattacharya, who are correctly calling into question some of the lazy assumptions we've made about the integrity of people who speak for scientific authority, those two things could go a long way towards revitalizing our civilization. You have to start somewhere. So even though I think it's premature to say that we've got a renaissance on our hands, it's not premature to say that there is now a definable segment of the population that has decided that they are no longer going to be shoved around by our cultural elite that wishes to treat us as subjects rather than as citizens.
Let me ask you about apathy, which is a factor you bring up in your article. You mentioned that we have a social system now that's so lacking in self-confidence that it looks on all of our civilizational issues and problems with bewildered impotence. But you say this apparent paralysis of the public is not so much apathy as it is cowardice. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I use that phrase while reflecting on what's been happening in New York City, where I live and work, where we've had, as I think most of the nation knows, some horrendous things like a Guatemalan illegal immigrant set a woman on fire on one of our subway lines and then just sat there and watched her burn to death. But he wasn't alone. There were other people in the car, subway car, and some of them, at least one of them, was filming what was going on. Now, one could say that's an instance of apathy, but I think what really happens is that many people in the city now are terrified to lift a hand to help those who are in distress. Now, distress doesn't always take the dramatic form I just mentioned, but it's very common to see people shoplifting, people jumping turnstiles, people bumping, assaulting other people. And it's also extremely common to see that the people standing around do nothing. So one question, do they not care? Well, if you stopped and talked to them, as I sometimes do, you find they do care, but they're afraid. What are they afraid of? They're afraid that if they do take action, they will be the ones who will be arrested and mistreated by the authorities. We have a prosecutor in New York City, Alvin Bragg, who basically turns a blind eye to anything he regards as petty criminality, and that's pretty much anything short of first-degree murder, unless it's committed by a white person or a majority person, in which case the police and the courts will come down hard on them. That was exemplified in the case of Daniel Penny, who was the also on a subway, put a chokehold on a man who was threatening to kill other passengers. Well, Penny went to trial, and the city spared no money at all in trying to turn his heroism into villainy. The jury didn't buy it. But nonetheless, I think what you're seeing there is that the message gets out, and gets out very clearly, that if you're living in this city and you want to get by, it's best to stand back and let the criminal class do what they're going to do and just hope you're not the victim that time. Well, that's a microcosm. Clearly, that doesn't describe the whole country. We're a big place. There are parts of the world where the American citizen faced with similar things would simply draw his license to carry gun and put an end to things. But there is nonetheless this element of sheer unwillingness to rise up and do what needs to be done. I think we've all probably seen in the last week or so citizens take action against the illegal alien who was carrying a blowtorch and setting fire to parts of Los Angeles that haven't already burnt down. The people who confronted him were not being cowardly, but not this same man or others like him had already set other fires that have destroyed tens of thousands of homes and caused all sorts of wreckage. There is an element here in which we could be helping ourselves if we had the gumption to do it. And I don't mean just intervening when someone goes off on an arson spree, but the interventions that would take place before that, by making sure that we have elected leaders who care about filling the reservoirs and having a staff of firefighters on hand who can rise to the occasion. There are many steps that we could take if we had the courage to do it. Why does that take courage? Well, in the case of California, demanding those sorts of things would probably get you painted as a racist. You were getting in the way of the DEI agenda of the fire chief and the mayor and the governor of the state, who put higher priority on their agenda for certain kinds of symbolism than on the practical arts of governing. Why do Californians elect and re-elect such people? There is in them, I think, a certain willingness to buy the fables that they're being told by their political leaders, but there's also just the plain fear of being marked out as someone who resists the contemporary jacket that we're all supposed to wear. And that's the cowardice that I think has prevailed in the last few years. Will President Trump lead us out of that? I hope so. He's clearly got a huge battle to fight to get there. Our settled government, not just in Washington, D.C., but in most of the states, is one in which the people who are enjoying life at public expense have no intention of giving up their privileges and have every intention of trying to stymie whatever actions are now needed to put us back on track. I don't want to sound as though I put all my faith in replacing one set of political leaders with another. I don't. I think where we really have to be is reliant on ourselves as fellow citizens who must be active in our governance, not reliant on other people to do it for us.
Let me shift gears a little bit and talk about another interesting aspect or concept of your article, and that is the notion of consent. You mentioned that since the sexual revolution, the only real sexual boundary that we have left now is consent. How is it a civilizational problem that we have elevated consent to such a first principle?
Well, the civilizational problem is that once consent is the only principle, there are no other boundaries. That is, consent means, first of all, that women can stand up against people who sexually assault them. So, okay, that sounds pretty good. Then next on the list is the rise of the gay rights movement and the desire to establish gay marriage. I'm much less on board with that than many contemporaries are, but I understand that Americans are now kind of resigned to that being the way we proceed. But we're not stopping there. We have moved on to attacking people on the age of consent. There is a movement called MAPS, or Minor Attracted Persons, who want to have sexual access to children. And we are engaged in this bizarre and truly anti-civilizational idea that we can abolish the sexes and replace them with this concept called gender, which itself is a bit doubtful, and then allow people of any age to decide that they want to emulate the bodies and the manners and the privileges of the opposite sex. All of that now travels under the broad canopy of consent as a justification. If it's something I want and I'm not directly imposing it on you, then consent is the open sesame that it provides access to anything. Now, I don't think you can go very far down that road without realizing that the ultimate aim of the consensualists, if I can invent a term for them, is the abolition of the family. The family is not a consensual institution. It may be founded on the consent of a man and woman who choose to marry one another, but beyond that, they have children, and children are, teenagers are frequently reminding us, I didn't choose to be born. Well, that's true, you didn't. We, the parents, chose to have you and to carry you to term in a pregnancy and to spend a great deal of our time and energy and resources to bring you up. The family is a necessarily hierarchical institution. Now, how hierarchical we want it to be has varied over the course of centuries, but nonetheless, it has an authority structure built into it. Parents are those who make the key decisions over what their children are going to do up to a certain age. Well, if you have replaced that authority structure with the principle of consent, the family ceases to be, or we have what are now called families of choice, choice being the word that permits the element of consent to come back into it. And that means that if a minor becomes in irreconcilable conflict with his parents, you could go to, say, Minnesota and say, I don't want those parents. They are choosing a gender for me that I don't agree to. And the state of Minnesota will say, okay, we give you immunity. We will protect you from those parents. That sort of thing is happening in other states as well, although I think Minnesota has gone furthest in this. California is close behind. What we are seeing in those instances is that the elements that make the family possible, that is, that it's a reproductive unit, that it is not just bringing children in the world, but it's teaching them how to be men and women, how to be fathers and mothers. The family reproduces itself generationally by making sure that the children grow up to be themselves the seeds of new families, and that they know how to be masculine and how to be feminine in appropriate ways. This decision to turn the family into a source of oppression comes, I think, most directly out of radical feminism. It's been teaching this doctrine for a long, long time, and it has taken root. So now in much of higher education, if you're going to learn anything at all about the family, you're going to learn that it is one of the deep fonts of oppression. It structures oppression and reproduces oppression. It doesn't do anything good, it just creates hierarchy, and hierarchy in itself is bad, unless you're a member of the Communist Party or something, and then the hierarchy is good.
And speaking of communism, the radical feminism that you mentioned and this gender ideology, they both really stem from the cultural Marxist assault on our civilization, don't they? I mean, Karl Marx literally called for the abolition of the family and its replacement with an emphasis on the collectivist raising of children and the state as our parent. So it's been a decades-long process by the cultural Marxists to eradicate the family, kind of remove the basic building block of our civilization. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Right after Marx had gotten going with this idea, his disciple Engels wrote a book in which he called for the abolition of the family directly. Now, I don't think Western Marxists took it very seriously for the first maybe 70 years after this notion was first propagated. It did have a brief trial in the Soviet Union immediately after the Russian Revolution, but even they pretty quickly decided that an anti-family state was not viable. But then along comes people like Simone de Beauvoir. De Beauvoir, never mind.
De Beauvoir.
Yes, thank you. We'll get tongue-tied. we were being instructed by the radical left of the European cultural scene that to be thoroughly up to date, one had to get on board with the idea that the family was a pernicious institution. It's taken quite a while for Americans to absorb that, but absorb it they have. And now I think we had that football player giving a commencement speech, I think that was 2 years ago now, that called for young women to at least consider the possibility of finding their destinies in being mothers. And it created a firestorm in higher education. How dare he say these sorts of things? Well, what he was saying is what I think deep down we all know to be true. And it's getting that truth back into play as something that we can talk about amongst ourselves, perhaps in churches, but maybe in schools if we're lucky. But popular culture is also conveyed to us through television, through movies, through the channels of mass communication that are controlled almost in their entirety by the woke left. So it's now much easier to find a movie celebrating queerness than it is to find a movie that celebrates any virtues in the nuclear family. There we are. We're talking generally about the decline of our civilization. I think that's as patent an indication of the decline of our civilization as we're likely to get. It's not that I mean any ill towards people who are drawn to same-sex relationships, but what they are calling for their own reasons to be accepted has turned into a weapon against the rest of us who are not same-sex attracted.
But that football player that you mentioned, that was Kansas City Chiefs kicker Harrison Butker, who made himself quite a lightning rod of controversy over that whole commencement speech that he gave. I actually wrote about that at the time. Let me shift slightly from one pillar of Western civilization, and that's the traditional family, to another one, and that is religious faith. You write in your article that our current nihilism arises partly from hatred of the Judaism and Christianity that made us. Why is religious faith so central to the flourishing of our civilization?
Well, I would say any civilization has to have a foundation, something that is accepted by the majority of its participants as being true and therefore having certain consequences. Judaism and Christianity give us the Ten Commandments. They give us a sense that there is a transcendental God that has a call upon our submission to his authority. The whole authority structure, whether it's of the family or the state, has in Western civilization depended on the idea that there is a difference between right and wrong, that difference is knowable, and the reason that it's knowable is that God has written into our hearts a knowledge of at least the basics of who we are as human beings and what we owe to one another to form a viable society. Now, of course, Western civilization encompasses a whole great number of societies, some of which were not Christian or Jewish, but which absorbed along their path many of the premises that made Christianity and Judaism so central. And ultimately, it was the Christian and Jewish versions of the civilization that prevailed, at least until recently. How recently, that's a complicated topic, but certainly by the late 19th century, people like Nietzsche are writing and drawing attention to the fact that Christianity had become stale, that people no longer thought that God was real and so on. Well, that might have been an avant-garde then, but now it prevails. The church that I attend here in Manhattan begins each service by announcing that it is a church for seekers, that it welcomes into the church service people who are atheists or agnostics or simply want to know something more. Well, I'm not opposed to that, but I find it very noteworthy that a Christian congregation in Manhattan these days sets itself up as something that is for those who are unchurched or dechurched or who have faint knowledge of what Christianity is all about. That's a cultural assumption that would have probably been unthinkable even 50 years ago, when it would have been assumed that the majority of the population at least knew what Christianity was, rather than as this exotic thing that had to be explained in its basics at every church service. So, I should add that church is among the more conservative ones in the city. There are others that are much more wide open in their embrace of what the popular culture has to offer, so that they fly their gay flags, their Black Lives Matter flags. They embrace everything that the cultural agenda of the left has put forward as now attractive and acceptable. So the question of how and why Christianity and Judaism are so central to who we are, I think, really just comes down to the recognition that these are places where the mass society used to see itself as at least having to draw on the resources which a belief in God offered. Well, that is no more. You mentioned earlier the multiculturalist aspect of this. That certainly comes into it as well. Islam sees no need at all for the forms of toleration and forgiveness that are central to the Judeo-Christian ethic. Hinduism is hugely tolerant of all sorts of views, but has no particular sense that there is a basic truth to be derived at. I don't really want to spend any time taking shots at other religions, but I would say that without Christianity, there really is not going to be any Western civilization for much longer.
You write that in your article that there is a way back from the brink of civilizational doom, but that we're going to have to choose it. What do you think? Are you optimistic, or maybe we should say hopeful, that we will choose it?
Well, it's more of a matter of faith than of rationality, but I think that, yes, I have to be hopeful, that I think we're called to have some hope, but it's a hope that is certainly chastened by the realization of just how far down in the hole we have come. And coming back from it is going to be a huge effort. But it's, you know, why I wrote for Gloria Greenfield, and what maybe why you did too, that there is no percentage at all in giving up. And so I have made it my life's work here at the National Association of Scholars to try to summon people to this huge effort to save just one institution, which is higher education. But I realize that one institution, important as it is, will not get us all the way to where we need to be. And so wherever possible, I try to reach out and find other ways to engage. We're doing that right now in this conversation. And I hope that there will be those who come upon your podcast and might say, well, I sort of agree with that. I'd like to know more. And there are places to go to learn more. We are a besieged cultural minority right now who have taken the stance that our civilization is in serious trouble. The result of this is that I find it, of course, much easier to talk with people who have already found some connection to the themes that we're discussing, but I also try very hard to reach people who are not within that charmed circle. Sometimes that means I get my share of hate mail, bizarre sorts of declarations of what a horrible person I am, and I kind of welcome those as an indication that somebody has heard me who didn't want to hear me and is disturbed enough to try to make my day uncomfortable. But am I optimistic as a whole? If I were just to sit back and do jigsaw puzzles, I would not be optimistic. But I'm not sitting back. I'm doing such things as I can with the talents that I have and with the determination that's come upon me. I'm used to seeing myself as a fairly young person, but I'm not young anymore, and I realize my time to make a difference will run out at some point, so I proceed with some urgency. There are things that need to be done and done now, and it's up to us to do them.
Well said. Peter, dare I ask if you have a new book in the works?
I am not working on a new book right now. My agenda at the National Association of Scholars has expanded to the point where I'm overseeing almost a dozen projects right now, each of which results in fairly hefty book-sized reports. So that's been taking up my time, though I would like to write another book. I think that the Wrath book really does require a sequel of some sort, and that's on my mind. So,
where's the best place for people to go to keep up with your work?
The National Association of Scholars website, which is just nas.org, and we have a parallel website called Minding the Campus, which is spelled just the way it sounds. You'll find my essays and those of my colleagues on those two places. I also publish pretty widely outside the prospects of my own domain here, so I'll appear in Spectator USA, American Conservative, American Greatness, sort of the usual places for folks like us.
Peter Wood, thanks for bringing your insights to The Right Take. I urge everybody to get your books, 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project, and the other one called Wrath, America Enraged. I think they're necessary reading for understanding what's happening at this intersection of politics and culture. Dr. Wood, please keep up the great work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so that you don't miss any of the important conversations we're having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. See you next time. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.